Black WNST, Towson, Baltimore, and Baltimore Positive. Says so right underneath of me. We're finally celebrating 30 years, and 30 years on the radio, I make all sorts of friends, and new friends as well. We're at the Beaumont. We're here in Catonsville. We're kicking this thing off. It is the Maryland Crab Cake Tour. It's all presented by our friends at the Maryland Lottery. We're letting ourselves play here, and we're going to be playing with some chops before it's all over. Look at Don studying the menu.
I'm looking
over
at
here.
The menu, man. I mean, I've been here a number of times, but you know, it's there are a lot of good choices here.
I stood right, literally, we're doing the show right at the bar because it's a smallish place. And when I think about the neighborhood part of the tour, right, we're in Catonsville, where life is great in the 21228. That I had to bring out one of my oldest, dearest friends to kick off the 30th anniversary. My high school guidance counselor and my soccer coach for all times, Petey Carinci, out here. I mean, how did you get lost on Frederick Avenue with the new AD? How did this happen?
We made a left and we should have made a right.
They zigged when they should have zagged.
Well, that's
you know. But
and I always had the window down, asking where you were.
How do you get back to the Final Four like that? You can't find your way.
Well, we know where that is.
Well, he's working on it. Pete Carinci has brought along a new friend. Nice to meet you, Brian Barrio. New,
great to be here.
New-ish athletic director, right?
I'm retiring the new, and we're going to go with just the athletic.
So Don says to me, like, how have you not met the new? Like, we had Freeman Hrabowski out. We've had all sorts of UMBC friends, and I said, there's been like a plague. You know, you took over like the worst time ever, right? Like, you
about
came in
what?
A couple weeks before the plague?
I want to say 60 days before.
I want to say, though, in the athletic director playbook, there wasn't a page for pandemic.
Yeah,
I don't
think. It's funny. They always ask you, what do you want to happen in your first 100 days on the job? And my answer was, I want to help contain the virus.
I want everybody
that's not
to
how I answered that question at the interview.
Well, this is going to be fun all the way around. Because Don, tell everybody who else we have coming today, because we have a full slate, new friends and old friends.
Oh,
I got a surprise visitor for you in the 4:30 hour.
Oh, my goodness.
I got a surprise.
Well,
we
have Councilman Tom Quirk, who also, we're going to really get into finances with Tom. Tom's one of the most successful financial planners actually in the United States, been recognized by Forbes magazine. So we're going to try to talk stock market, make sense of everything that's going on. A new little wrinkle for us today, Nestor. We're going to have the pastor of Catonsville United Methodist Church, Pastor David Jacobs. We're going to talk a little faith. And
he told me I was going to find God before today.
Yeah, the whole place, we might all be set on fire today. So we're going to talk about, I kidded the pastor that, you know, this season for them is their Super Bowl. I mean, this, you talk about going to the Final Four. This is it. We'll talk about that. We got Megan Lynch from the Chamber. And very excited, we have Ed Laverne, the CEO of St. Agnes Hospital Ascension. Again, I'm sure we'll be talking some pandemic there. So it's a big day here at the Beaumont.
Well, the reason for the season is the 30th anniversary. And I want to talk about UMBC, but you and I, we go back a long ways, you know. And anytime you lose, I console. When you win, I send you a little love. But I haven't been in a room with you since the beginning of the plague. The plague has done strange things because Zoom has made us all sort of ambient. And then you, like, rub elbow. It's good to see. Last time I saw you, we were having dinner at the Chicago concert.
Yes.
At Roos Chris.
They're coming back, by the way.
They are coming back.
The 80s are coming back, too.
I got a friend I was with last night, little aside, jumping in, shouldn't interrupt, who will be seeing them for the 58th time. You know, that kind of thing. Just, I'm like, what are you doing?
It's a lot of Saturdays in the park, man.
58th time.
It's
exactly.
25 or 6 to 4.
Exactly.
So we get together and we have a plague, and you, soccer goes on, school goes on, athletic department goes on, the gym opens up, we play basketball. This has been a fascinating couple of years, I would think, from a recruiting, from all of that, as a departure for what was normal life before the plague.
Everything that was normal in coaching was changed, from the recruiting to going into work to dealing with your athletes, the practice times across the board. And it really was a strange time. And I thought Brian helped us navigate a really good, great situation, because it was very difficult at the time to, you know, are we going to practice? Are we even going to do anything? And some schools, obviously, you know, were much more supportive than others. And he did a fantastic job of helping us get through the spring of last year and then this past season.
Brian, I'll be honest. I mean, I've been in sports. It's my 30th year. I did sports exclusively the first 27 years. The last 3 years, we've mixed more things in. And then the plague came. And then there was no sports to talk about anymore. I don't think I've talked to an athletic director. I mean, it's crazy about the challenges. And we're Coppin State. We're the voice of Coppin State. We run their games. Obviously, you know, they had their issues around that time. But sports stopped. That probably changed everything about your gig, not let alone coaches' gigs, knowing that you had a season coming in September that you're preparing for. But when the kids are off campus and you just don't know, give me that, because you're probably settling and trying to figure out where Frederick Road is. I'm glad that you navigated.
I still don't know.
That's how we got to the Beaumont.
Straight out Frederick Road.
He drove.
Ellicott City.
But no, it's you know, there is no playbook for it, and we in athletics talk all the time about how every day is different and every day is unpredictable, but this was a whole different level of unpredictability. And the hardest thing for me was, like I said, 60 days after I got there, having to go to all our spring sports teams that were about to start their seasons on March 12th to tell them we're not playing. And it was heartbreaking, and it was really difficult when you haven't established a relationship with those young men and women yet. So it was
the first news was bad news.
Yeah, like the first time I sat with some of those teams as a individually with the team was to tell them like, hey, there's a plague going around, and we're not going to play.
We had Brandon Scott on at Coco's 2 weeks ago, first day on the job as mayor, and shut the city down.
It's unbelievable.
But if you feel like the conviction is what it has to be, you didn't have any choice.
We were ahead of the game, and I'll always be proud of this, and Freeman Hrabowski, our president, was right on top of it. But before our conference and before the NCAA made the decision, me, him, Greg Simmons, and our Office of Advancement sat down together and said, like, I don't care what the league does, we can't play. Like, we can't put them out there right now. It was really clear that it wasn't going to be a go. And so we started meeting with our teams. And fortunately, I got to all of our spring teams that morning. I don't know if you remember this, Pete, but I got to all of them that morning in person. And minutes after I finished the last one, it broke on Twitter that America East wasn't going to play their season. So all the other schools learned.
March 16th, 17th?
I want to say it was March 13th.
Well, the Friday the 13th was when everything shut down.
The Thursday night is when the basketball thing happened, right. And I was at an event that night. So I think we all sort of knew. So when you say you're breaking the news, I think we all sort of found out on Twitter the world was going to shut down. Right?
I think there was a feeling at the time, if I can put myself back in that time, I think there was a feeling that like maybe we just hold off for a week or two. You know, maybe we're shut down today, but we're going to play.
Oh,
next
I love
week.
President Trump's 14-day plan. Yeah, how did that work out? Right. Not so good.
But I don't think
we'll
it was
be good
clear
to go
then.
By Easter.
Remember they held up the chart.
We'll be doing like Easter egg. We'll be Easter egg hunting by Easter.
We have three cases. They're all going away by the end of the week. Yeah, I always have to point that out because I just do. But Freeman Hrabowski, you said his name last time we were with Freeman was over at State Fair. Which, by the way, the Beaumont. For those of you who can't find it on Google, Pete Carinci, it's just kitty-cornered here and right down the street from El Guapo, and Evan's going to be by a little later on. We're celebrating the holidays and all of that. But, during this period of time, and I guess I go back to 2 years ago, the notion that there would be no sports, I was a sports radio station, right? Freeman is the soothsayer of all this. He was one of our last guests before the plague.
Absolutely.
We had him over maybe January, so maybe 8 weeks or so before the plague. And you take a gig here, and I would think Freeman's probably at a big part of that. And when you're looking at leadership, when you're coming off the plane saying, I'm new here, I don't know anybody here, Freeman, he brings a credibility with him that is, I don't know what to say. I mean, he's one of our favorite people in the world.
It doesn't hurt to have 30 years of experience in the role, when you're trying to navigate something that's unprecedented like that. So I think if you've got a president who's been on the job for a year or two and they haven't even seen all the routine things you're going to see, it's got to be much harder for them to make some of the calls that have to be made than it is for Freeman Hrabowski, who's seen everything on a college campus in 30 years. Yeah, I felt really good.
I always tell the story, Brian and Pete, a couple of years ago when 60 Minutes did the story on Freeman. And my phone began to light up in the next couple of days. I had relatives out of state, friends out of state, and they're going, You know that guy? I go, yeah. Go, he seemed unbelievable. Is that all true? Or I said, oh, and then some.
Sure. I get that all the time. Is he really like that? And like, when you're alone with him, and he really, really is. And how many people with that personality, like his charisma in public, is really like that in private and can be that compelling one-on-one, and he really can.
Well, Pete doesn't know anything different because Pete's been here for forever and ever. Pete ain't going anywhere. You've been a lot of places. I mean, give me a little allure for UMBC, because I'm sure when you Googled UMBC, Catonsville, Maryland, and and you're like, the Final Four and what Pete has done, what the programs are doing, what lacrosse represents in our community, and there's a history there as well. For UMBC and coming in, I guess, became famous with the basketball program and that win, right?
Yeah, it's a little different for me because I had been at the conference office. I worked at the America East office about 10 years ago, and I went on and did other things. I was out at Pepperdine in California and at the University of Nevada. So I always knew what UMBC was, and I've told people before, when I was at the conference office, I thought of this as a sleeping giant. I thought it was a place that could do great things in athletics. And while I was away, they won that game against Virginia, which, right. You know, that's the definition of great things. And so that's one of the many things that they can do, and Pete taking the team to the Final Four. Nobody would have ever predicted that UMBC could be in a Final Four.
I went to Omaha for the first time in my life.
That's right.
I literally went to Omaha for the first time in my life in the summer to see the Eagles. When I screwed my back up. So I'm walking around Omaha. It was a beautiful day. It was like 85 degrees in Omaha. And I'm walking around, and I saw the stadium. And I looked over, and I'm
Creighton.
Like, I watched a web stream from there. Jen was fighting for her life when you were in the Final Four.
That's right.
That was 15, right?
That's right,
15,
yeah.
Right?
14.
Yeah. She, both years. So, yes, yeah. it was in 14. And we watched the stream, and I remember the stadium. And if you think of Omaha, I think of the College World Series. I think of him getting a huge win, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That was a nice plane ride back there,
oh,
right?
Oh, we floated back.
Yeah. See, I remember.
What do you recall about that season, Pete, from soup to nuts, from beginning to end? When you sit down and you're just relaxing in a quiet moment, what do you recall about that season?
You have quiet moments?
What I remember the most was how, from the beginning to the end, that we had a band of kids from the area that really believed that we could do it. And we actually talked about it early on. And, you know, like you say, if you would have said that to people, 99% of them would have said, what are you kidding? You're not going to the Final Four. But I think the kids really believed it. I believed it. It was a dream. And we just went from – that was our goal from the very beginning. So as the closer we got, the more I just thought it was like destiny. And I would tell them that it's meant to happen. And, you know, I really did believe that we could win the whole thing. And, you know, we were close enough to – happening, but obviously we got that goal called against us early in the game against Virginia. So, but clearly, I thought, and so did the players, and it was a whole Baltimore group of kids that grew up playing with one another, were in high school competing, club games. And it was the perfect storm. They all came back, and
I smell a 10-year reunion.
Is that team still close, Coach?
Oh, very close. Yeah, and most of the teams, we do a really good job of bringing championship groups back. So that group is very, very close. They can't wait to another one of our reunions. They'll come to a game, and, you know, it's like our old University of Baltimore team. Ironically, we just had our 47th anniversary, and we don't even have a program. The school doesn't even have athletics anymore. And
but we have two alums here.
We all got back on last Friday night, and the turnout was great, and we just won Tex. You know, congratulations, it's our anniversary, and everyone comes back. So that's when you know you have a really tight team, and this team is very tight, and they'll come back to all our events.
How crazy is that today? I was at the radio station a couple hours ago, and I'm cleaning some stuff out there, and I found my diploma. It's University of Baltimore. And I'm thinking, I never proudly say soccer champions back in the 70s, you know. Yeah, I don't ever. No, hey, Karinji's no here. One. Brian Berrios here.
Hey, we've just had Hall of Fame basketball coach
You know, here's the thing I noticed. What you need to know, okay? You're new to Catonsville, okay? Brian Berrios, athletic director. Of course, Don Moeller's here. If you're going to be in Catonsville at any point, at any time, you're going to be in a room with someone related to Don Moeller, okay? So I'm just being honest. Never a time I've been in Catonsville where I don't – I walk into Atwater's to get a muffin, and there's some cousin of his serving it to me.
Well, it's easy to do. I always tell Nestor, if your grandfather was one of a dozen or so, and they were all Catholic, and they all lived in the area, it sort of becomes a geometric progression. But my brother, Mike Moeller, Hall of Fame basketball coach, Catonsville High School, just walked in. We probably, before we get out of here, we'll get him to come up and give us an update on the leading scorer in the nation in Division I women's basketball right now, Catonsville graduate Jasmine Dickey, who's up at the University of Delaware.
Wow.
And had a little injury this week. I think he can update us on that. But tremendous, tremendous player. I want to ask both of you, and boy, there's been a lot of discussion this week in the wake of the Mark Turgeon situation. I was not at the game when the fans turned on, I guess it was Virginia Tech, I guess, at the end of the game, when they started to chant to fire him and everything. But from what I'm hearing and folks that I talk to, that really took a toll. I mean, that was, we don't think about it. We think of coaches as being bulletproof, but that took a toll. And I guess my question is, in this day and age, I guess Pete, you and then the athletic director, how much tougher is it to coach today than it was 15 or 20 years ago? And what sort of, I mean, I understand people were harassing, you know, Turgeon's kid in the community, and his wife was getting, I mean, that's ridiculous stuff. How much tougher is it today, Coach?
Well, I think it's a lot tougher, and it's only going to get tougher. It starts, one, with social media, the ability to get on and have your own opinion. Everyone has opinion. Everyone has, you know, the right to get on and criticize someone. They come to the games. Parents have kind of groomed these kids for a lot when they're young to get a scholarship to go play pro, putting pressure on kids, travel here, there. And it wasn't like going back just 15, 20 years ago where the kids didn't. Right now, they have the college student has more power than ever. He could leave like that, or you know, go back 5, 10 years ago before the portal. They had to come to us. They had to have communication with us. There was a little bit more loyalty in that sense that, you know, I'm going to stay at the school. I committed to the school. Now you can leave in a heartbeat. And in every sport, you see it, and it's only getting worse. So I think it's really the pressure on coaches to be successful, especially at that level. You know, I've been fortunate to have success on and off the field and have great athletic directors and people I can deal with, and a president who's always been understanding of us.
You've had a really good gig.
I've had a great
gig. I mean, as
I've
far as coaches gig. Go, I mean, yeah. You've been a great coach, and I can, you know, kiss your butt as a friend or as media member or whatever. But that it really is unprecedented in this day and age for you as an athletic director who's bounced around a little, because that's part of the gig, is getting jobs and moving around. It's hard to stay in one place. It's rare, really rare.
And, well, the loyalty's rare. The loyalty from the kids, the loyalty from the coaches, and the loyalty from the administrators.
That's what I want to talk about, the loyalty from the kids. Because one of the things I hear in basketball world, and I don't know enough about soccer world, embarrassingly enough, but maybe you can educate us. In basketball world, you hear a lot of fingers being pointed towards the AAU culture, the AAU environment. You know, in some ways, the AAU experience is more influential on a kid than high school coaches. That was unheard of when we were growing up, probably even 20 or 25 years ago. Is there an AAU component to youth soccer as well that becomes difficult?
It's club soccer. You know, club soccer has gotten bigger and bigger. Coaches are getting paid. You know, parents are directly involved. I'll go back to example like Mr. Karpovich. Back in the day, I went to Calvert Hall. You know, everything was centered around the high school team, and we all played great club teams. We all left, but we all knew that Calvert Hall was really the main base of what we were doing. But there became a point where parents got so much more involved. Kids were traveling. Kids were couldn't play in a high school game because they had to go with their club team.
Yeah, it's crazy.
And that loyalty that they had, it's totally changed. So now we're 15 years later, and that's prevalent, and it's all over the place. So that now has seeped into the college level, especially now with the portal. They can come. If they don't play immediately, they're going to come in, and they want to talk to you. They want to meet with you. And you know, the loyalty of, hey, we want you to be a part of this over the next 4 years, get your degree, get your education. We're talking about reunions, right? We had a reunion. You're talking about reunions. Does our team come back? Yeah. But for the most part, a lot of these kids playing on their club teams, they'll never have a reunion because they're there for a year. They're there for 6 months. They're going to another team. They're going to another team. Teams are literally taking – clubs are literally taking teams that are very successful and taking them in their club because, you know, they can win a championship. Well, so the loyalty part of, I grew up in East Baltimore. Right. I played for Pompeii, and you played for St. Elizabeth, and it was across the street. And we were brothers. We went to school together. But when you play on your team, there was the loyalty, almost like it is overseas. In the English teams, you know, you followed your team. If you're a Raven fan, you're a Raven fan. You're not a D.C. fan. You're not a Steeler fan. But in the youth soccer system right now, and it's happening in basketball everywhere.
Well, what does that require you to do, Coach? And then, Brian, I'm going to come to you for the athletic director's take on this. What does it require you to do now as a coach when they arrive in the summer or in the spring, and you're trying to create a sense of team when they're coming from all these clubs and it's been me, me, me? What does that How does that play out?
I think the first thing you do is let them know it's now we. And right. if you're a me kind of player at UMBC soccer, you're not going to survive. And that was one of the things to this day that I've stressed from the day they get there. I'll have individual meetings with them. We'll have constantly communication. Probably meet with these players the last 2 years more than I did the last 10 years, especially the ones that aren't playing, and just make them feel good about being a part of it. But the me, from the we to the me, has changed so much. And that starts with the pros. You know, everybody's pointing, you know, at themselves. Everybody's putting themselves on social media. You know, there's a day doesn't go by where you see an athlete, especially Instagram, all these different forums of putting themselves in there and talking about themselves. And as a coach, it's very frustrating because everything I stress is always about the team. And that's why we've been successful. We've had some really good teams.
Brian, what's your take on this? You're overseeing all the programs. You're trying to build, you know, powerhouses and cohesive units all across campus. What's the role of the athlete? Tell folks what you do as an athlete. Anybody saying, what does an athletic director do?
Besides direct Pete right. how to get to the Beaumont.
Yeah. Right. Right. Yeah. What does an athletic director do?
Sit confused in a car while we're driving.
Right, right.
No, I mean, there's a lot of things. It's such a complicated enterprise now. I mean, we've got 400 athletes. We've got, I don't know, 40-something coaches. X number of alumni, X number of students, we have all these different constituencies that we're trying to work with to keep happy. And at any given time, we may have four or five teams on the road. We may have a game going on here. We may be doing an alumni event. And you're really just trying to stay on top of and help, you know, Pete and I were just talking about it today. It's really about managing the people and helping the people in the department be the best they can be at whatever their role is. So whether it's our athletic trainers, whether it's our compliance office, whether it's our sports medicine folks, it's making sure that they're able to be in a position to be successful. And it obviously goes down to the coaches and the student athletes. It's a complicated thing. And then the part that people don't see, and certainly when you're talking about a Big Ten school or a, you know, Power Five school, is, you know, you're also part of a university. And it's, what are we doing to advance the university's mission? How are we interacting with the president and the president's council and the faculty and all that stuff? So it's really making sure that we're helping to move forward the university's mission.
What do both of you tell? What's the Nestor, I think, calls it the elevator speech. I think that's Nestor's term. What do you got? You got this recruit, this kid from St. Joe or Calvert Hall or Loyola, wherever it is, and you really want them, you know, Lock Raven, Caton, you really want them to come to UMBC. What's the elevator speech? Why it's the right place for them?
I know what mine is when I get with parents. I'm sure Pete's got a well-polished one after many years. But for me, this is the best place where you can be, you know, we talk about student-athlete. This is the best place where you can be not just a student, not just an athlete, but also that other part of you that's more than both of those, which is your family, your faith, all the other things in your life, where we can make sure that in 4 years you'll be a better and a more complete person than you were when you got here. And I don't think every place can promise you that when you come in to be an athlete.
How do parents react to that speech?
They like it.
It's thing.
It's true. I wouldn't. I always. I mean, I've got three kids of my own, and I will not talk to recruits for a coach.
Well, you picked your life up and moved here. So, you know, Brian Berrios here, a new-ish athlete. I've never met you because of the plague. So, Petey, I appreciate you bringing the new AD out. I talk to him all the time. You know, we have steak. When he can find the Beaumont, I'll have a steak here with him. But you take a gig here. What was it? Because you worked in the conference, as you said. And I think you and I may have crossed paths in some way with Boston College right around 99 or 2000, because I was syndicated when you were working with the coach up there.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah, he came down to Champions. But nonetheless, you've been at all these places. Why here? And had you driven on the campus? The campus at UMBC... And I've been on a lot of campuses, watched a lot of basketball games, soccer games. I've been in sports forever. The UMBC thing feels sort of, no offense, like Columbia, like a planned university, that it feels so functional and circular. And when you drive there, you feel like you're in a little Pleasantville of university. At least I do. My son always wanted to go to UMBC. He didn't have the grades, but he wanted to.
His father.
Hey, I went to UB.
That was cheating right up for you. No, to me, again, it comes down to where, and I think why we're really well positioned to be a successful university. We're focused on STEM. You know, like most of our majors are STEM majors.
That's why I couldn't get in.
But, you know, right now, trying to be a liberal arts school right now in this kind of economy, in this environment, it's difficult. And I think we're a place that really prepares people for careers. You know, you look at how many of our student athletes are working at NASA, at the NSA, at all these different, you know, high tech cybersecurity, all these different areas. That's not happening at every school in the country right now. And it's a place where you can be a high-level athlete and do that. And I think that's a meaningful pitch to people.
I think it's different being an AD here than it is being in Maryland, something where what we just witnessed, and I've talked about it all week, highest paid guy in the States, basketball coach,
oh, yeah,
right? And then you're the boss of that, and they don't win. And there's nothing other than winning. No offense to winning. We all want to win. But there's a different thing happening here in Catonsville.
Well, it's really important to win.
That's going on in Alabama's football program.
You got
to
win the right way. And you know, I've never been at Maryland. I would never talk about College Park. But for me, I was at USC, which is in that stratosphere, too. And I loved USC, and I loved working there.
Well, we saw
there,
what they did this week.
And I never want to be there again.
Right.
I really like the way we do things at this level, and it's particularly at this school, and that I'm able to go to bed and sleep at night and feel good about what I did all day with young people, as opposed to sometimes when you're in that stratosphere, that's not necessarily the way it is.
Let's talk about that as we sort of come to the end of the interview. Pete, I'm not going to ask you to throw Brian Kelly under the bus. That's not fair. But When as a fan, when I look, and it gets to what Nestor's talking about, the whole big-time athletic piece, when I look at the money in certain college programs and a coach walking in to meet with his players and 2 minutes later walking out, how does that square with the reason you got into coaching?
And you got to answer this with a Southern accent.
Well, I think, you're in Catonsville. Maybe just make it a Southern Baltimore accent.
I think it's very difficult. And I remember, you know, I've had several different opportunities since I've been at UMBC to move on.
I was going to ask you about that.
I did.
Did you ever really think
about
it? No, but do you ever think about taking a college job somewhere?
Yes.
You did?
Yes,
okay,
yes.
All right.
I probably was like, an hour away from taking a college position.
And the blast thing was in the paper.
And it would have been a good, good position also.
You know, but there was media pressure on that blast job.
I want to jump back.
I'll give you the answer. Yeah. I met immediately with Dr. Hrabowski up in his office. And within 30 minutes, you know, I decided to stay. You know, the grass ain't greener, always on the other side. And clearly, I look back on my experience at UMBC and look back, and I never wanted to be one of those coaches that was always going here and there, just always trying to chase something. Obviously, I love the area. I'm from the area. I'm a Hollandtown boy who, as I always say, born, raised, and will die here. But clearly, I love the area. I fell in love with UMBC, and my story is that when I played against them, I broke my leg in the first game of my second year at University of Baltimore. So I broke my leg. And I hated UMBC, and I wanted them to lose and everything. And somehow, you know, I guess fate, God, led me to UMBC. I went over and talked to Dr. Brown, said I would drive it over to the place. I said, you know, I'll be here like 3 years, and I'll be gone. The first game, I just left with the Maryland Bays. We had press conferences. We were on national TV, a pro team. All the coaches from that were going to coach in the MLS, so I had a good chance to go in the MLS possibly 2 years later. And I'm at UMBC, and in my first game of the year, there's literally like 17 people at the game, and half of them are my family.
And they drove from Essex. They were at Essex,
right?
Right.
And so I'm sitting there, and I'm thinking, what am I doing here? You know, why did I make this decision? And looking back, you know, when we had that sellout a couple years ago against Maryland, and people couldn't get into the facility, and we were turning people away, and obviously I went back and talked to Dr. Hrabowski because we needed stands. I mean, we can't have people sitting on the hill. And the school responded in a great way. And I look back with great pride because I helped build something in my hometown, and I didn't need to leave. And yet I know how tough that had to be to go in and talk to your team, because if I was going to leave, I became very close to those players. But I also realized that if you have to leave, you can't not want to leave because of the players, because they're all going to go their way one day. So you got to do what's best for you and your family. In my situation, it's –
my guess is, Pete, you would have taken more than 2 minutes talking to the kid. You don't have to comment. That's my editorial comment.
Pete Carangi, what a great way to kick off 30 years.
How about this?
I got deep thoughts with Pete.
You got the A-team. You got the AD.
It's a pretty good local kickoff, is it not?
Well, I'll tell you what. We're going to fire up the kitchen here. We're at the Beaumont. It's all brought to you by our friends at the Maryland Lottery. We're letting ourselves play. It's my 30th anniversary. It's the Crab Cake Tour. There will be crab cake served, from what I understand, before it's all over with, as well as a chop to go home with my wife. Don Moeller's here.
And we're going to have a little religion coming your way. way. Holy mackerel, look out, Nestor.
I'm going to find money, religion, basketball.
Dundalk soccer. Hall of Famer.
Dundalk Hall of Fame. I was there that night.
You give me a hard time about losing to Mervo. No. Are you doing that? You know what I did last week? So Dundalk's in the state championship.
The mayor has not stopped crowing yet.
Well, Johnny O made a bet with the mayor, right? And it was about wearing a jacket. So I didn't make any bets with the mayor, although I did get into the Twitter thing with them. I said, I have a jacket that will fit Mayor Scott very well, so I get involved in it. Now we get out of the game, we score once, we take the ball away, we score, it's 13-0. I'm wearing my Dundalk jacket, which still fits, by the way, Pete. It does, still fits, right? And I started tweeting out at the mayor, just brazenly, do you want to come over at halftime and just put it on?
Oh, man.
We give up 22 unanswered points. High school football is all about the red zone. You get down to the 8-yard line, you can't kick the thing, you can't push it in. It's like a tug of war, right? But we lost, and I lost, and the mayor. I woke up the next day. I literally woke up bleary-eyed. I put my glasses on. I'm using the facilities. I look down on my phone. First thing on my Twitter, the mayor destroying me. You know,
you're gonna sing the Dundalk fight song for the mayor before we get out of here.
Yeah, he has to.
For you or for the mayor?
For the mayor.
I know the Mervo fight song.
I know the Dundalk fight song.
He sings the Mount St. Joe fight song. I know the Dundalk fight song. I can sing it even in defeat. You know, it's like when they play that sad song when Notre Dame loses. You know what I mean? Like
St. Joe, purple and cream mean victory.
Oh my God.
See our colors.
Sorry, Brian.
Let each fellow join our chorus, echo far and
near. And that's it from the Boma.
Brian, I didn't tell you we were going to a karaoke dinner.
I am Nestor. Brian Berrio. Petey Carinci, elbows up. Don Moeller, we're back from the Beaumont. It's all brought to you by the Maryland Lottery. Let yourself play and let yourself stay.